for me, when I set out to write it, you know, I did want to kind of speak to our experience of, you know, kind of like exactly what you're saying, those kind of feelings of insecurity, insufficiencies, and not being able to speak the language. And what does that mean to be Asian American? Because you're kind of stuck between two worlds in a lot of way. You're not, you know, Asian enough for Asians, and you're not American enough for Americans, apparently. So you always have this kind of like in-between identity. And in a way, we kind of form our squad with each other.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Culturally Relevant, a podcast about film, television, art, and culture. Today, I'm going to be speaking with Bao Tran, who made this film called The Paper Tigers. I got to tell you about this movie, The Paper Tigers. It's extraordinary. The movie has 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. It stars three people of color as the protagonists. It's set in Seattle, and it's a martial arts comedy. Basically, it's everything David Chen would want in a movie. But if you're a fan of martial arts or comedies more generally, I think you'll find a lot to appreciate here, even if you aren't David Chen. Bao Tran tells the story of three middle-aged men who have to avenge their fallen master with sensitivity, with poignancy, and with a lot of love. Not to mention, the action in this movie really delivers. The fight scenes are well choreographed and shot with the sensibility of someone who clearly loves older Asian martial arts films. The movie's great. You should check it out. And I had a lot of fun chatting with Bao about his journey to get this movie made. It's really powerful to hear him talk about how difficult it was to get financing and how gratifying it has been to see the movie become a hit now that it's out. So stay tuned for my chat with Bao, of course. But before we get to that, mention a couple quick things about the podcast. If you enjoy this podcast, check out more episodes at culturallyrelevantshow.com or wherever podcasts can be downloaded. You can also email us at culturallyrelevantshow@gmail.com. If you want to support the show, there's a couple really easy ways to do so. First thing is you could follow this podcast on Twitter at CrevShow. That's CrevShow. You can also leave a podcast review for us on Apple Podcasts. That really does help me to get more guests in the future. And also you could back me on Patreon at patreon.com/Dave Chen. I want to thank all my executive producers at patreon.com/Dave Chen. Scott Wachholz, Stephen Miller, Sid Yadav, Steve Austin, Dan Flanagan, Jeff Evans, and Mark Warner. Thanks so much to them and all the fine folks over at patreon.com/Dave Chen for making my work possible. Sign up at patreon.com/Dave Chen for exclusive audio and video content. That's where it's at, folks. All right, let's get to my chat. Bao Tran is the director and writer of The Paper Tigers, which is available for purchase right now on video on demand. There are also theatrical screenings in theaters happening, which you should go see if you feel it is safe to do so. The Blu-ray for Paper Tigers will be available later in June. Here's my conversation with Bao, followed by our weekly recommendations.
No more challenges. Kung Fu without honor is just fighting.
Three tigers, baby.
Go, Jim!
Oh! Oh, my goodness. Yeah, yeah. Go. That's right. How that taste, old man?
Dad.
Yeah, buddy.
Do you know any kung fu?
I'm retired.
Who's the old guy?
That was our teacher. We called him Sifu.
You didn't hear? Safe was dead. Something's not right.
There was no heart attack.
Do you think the poison fingers is real?
Yeah, Gao Sao. But yeah, don't ching shao.
Can I just say it in English?
Just say it in English, man.
Bao Tran, thanks so much for joining me today on Culturally Relevant.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me.
So I usually like to start with breaking in stories. How would you say you broke into the filmmaking industry?
Oof, how did I break water? I started at an early age just making films, like in my backyard, with my best friends and all that stuff. So we, you know, I did the whole kind of VHS, filmmaking and gathering all the friends and writing a story and editing and doing this all kind of like homemade on VHS decks. So, it just kind of grew from there, and it grew into, I guess, you know, a bigger, more ambitious stories. And pretty soon, you know, we had needs to actually hire people or have people work on it for free. Let's say that's how it started out, that weren't my friends. So yeah, I think it was all kind of an organic thing, as far as, you know, the industry itself, like the first paid gig, you know, I would do like wedding gigs and.
Well, before we get to paid gig, like what, was it that inspired you to want to be into films?
Yeah, well, I grew up watching Hong Kong movies and like TV serials at home. You know, family would go rent or borrow these, 30 packs of VHS tapes of entertainment from Asia. And so we'd watch that at home. And then outside in kind of the multiplexes, I'd watch, your Spielbergs and James Cameron and, all the standard Hollywood fare. So that was kind of my whole diet. I grew up watching Bruce Lee, who had that kind of like middle area because he was on TV. So it was like, hey, here's an Asian guy, but he was also on, broadcast TV. He had his movies on like Kung Fu Theater and all that. So it had all that things growing up. But it wasn't until Jackie Chan and really getting into Jackie Chan that I wanted to make movies. So Bruce Lee was kind of this figure that's like, oh my gosh, he's great. He's awesome. You kind of watch him just as a person to marvel at. Mm-hmm. But Jackie Chan, for some reason, had a feel and a rhythm to his filmmaking that I just wanted to figure out. Like, I just wanted to understand what he was doing.
Bruce Lee, obviously like a legend, mm-hmm. but I feel like Jackie Chan is more of an entertainer to me, mm-hmm. than Bruce Lee mm-hmm. was. Mm-hmm. And it always feels like he's just trying to like put on a good show, whereas I don't necessarily get that from Bruce Lee.
Well, there's an accessibility factor to him. And I think I could feel that the filmmaking was, it was really tangible, just the way the cutting and the way it was done with rhythm and the music right. and the fighting and stuff. And that just led me down a rabbit hole because I wanted to figure out what inspired him. And he would always say Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin and Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire. So that kind of opened up that road for me to kind of go down and study that. So then I started falling in love with movies as a whole. I started, liking action movies, but then he opened the door as far as like understanding filmmaking and comedy and storytelling and all that. That just kind of like blew the door open for me in terms of just like wanting to be a filmmaker and so-called getting into the industry.
So you said you were making like short films with your friends. What were the short films about?
They were all martial arts themed. They were all like, I fashioned myself to be a Jackie Chan, protege. I was like, okay, he's a guy who stars and acts and writes and directs and edits and do all that. And, maybe I was the only one that really had a real passion for it among my friends. So, I became the natural ringleader in that sense. But I was kind of doing all this stuff, like martial arts stuff. And my friends who maybe didn't even know martial arts, but they're big, tall, and white. So, I kind of used them as dummies and springboards and all that stuff. So it was just all like really slapsticky and funny stuff and just kind of like, trying to imitate the things that you like.
So you were talking about how you got your first paid gig. You're doing weddings, filming weddings, it sounds like.
Yeah. So it's funny. It's like, what does it mean to get paid? What does it mean to kind of get into the industry and, have your first so-called paycheck? But, I was using my skills and abilities to do weddings and kind of videography gigs. And again, making short films while that was happening. And, just every short film got bigger and bigger. So I had to find like other side hustles to figure out, how to raise the money to do, bigger and bigger shorts.
So your bio says that you were mentored by action director Corey Yuen. How did that come about?
Yeah, Corey was a family friend. I went to high school with his kids, his family. So that's how I got to know him. So that was almost this kind of like charmed magical fairy dust moment, to kind of meet the master, because I was trying to figure out, how Jackie Chan and, all the Hong Kong filmmakers did it. And then I'm not from a showbiz family or a family or film entertainment. So this was just me trying to figure things out on my own before YouTube, mind you, and before, any type of tutorials that were online. I was just kind of grasping in the dark. But then, Corey, came into my life and he was just this huge mentor to me and just kind of give me the ideas and the tips and the tricks and about filmmaking. And, he was the one who kind of disabused me of starring in my stuff. He was just like, if you're going to direct, you should just direct. So maybe that was a very gentle way of telling me I was a bad actor, but, so I took that, to heart, and I basically focused on being behind the camera and just kind of trying to figure out the craft.
Why did he recommend that, do you think?
I think for him, he was like, there's just so much attention to detail when you're directing, is that when you're acting, you have like split attention. So especially maybe because I was starting out and learning things, he was like, just focus on this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, are there any other big insights that you learned from him? Like, did you show him some of your short films and he commented on them? Like, how did it work?
Yeah. I mean, I would show stuff that I was working on. He'd give tips and tricks and just kind of stuff to kind of play, even just the nitty gritty craft stuff. You know, he'd show me his stuff, his movies and stuff, and kind of do walkthrough comment, almost like live commentary of some of the scenes that he was working on and the way he was thinking and just kind of like stuff like that. And just in general, kind of just kind of like even just light or film life advice about how to kind of navigate the industry and, you know, thinking about, really thinking about the story. I think that was probably the biggest takeaway, is like he would say, like, you can't have good action without good story. So it was always a way of figuring out, like, it's not just designing cool fight moves or core action moves. It's like figuring out what's happening with the characters and how do you kind of push that forward. So that, you know, the audience is engaged. You know, sometimes even the engagement of the characters is more enticing than the choreography itself. So that was like, in a way, to kind of like let that light bulb moment. It's like, oh, it's not just the moves. It's not just the thing. But if you had both, you know, you have a great combination from that. And yeah, just thinking about the audience for the world, maybe again, this was kind of pre-YouTube, all that. But, you know, I was making movies for my friends, you know, we'd watch it, we'd laugh at it, it entertained us, you know, it entertained our near circle. But he was, you know, making movies for the world. So it just got me to be really aware of the movies that we were making, the stories that we were telling, is that you got to be aware that, you know, someone across the world might see this. And so that just kind of like broadened my horizons, just to think, you know, internationally, think globally, think, you know, the entire human family, if you will. And just think about, you know, how stories can come across that way. And I think that goes back to, you know, the Chaplin and all this, like the huge influence that Chaplin has. I mean, that's the broad success that he's had is exactly a testament to that.
I think my favorite action movies are the ones where every action scene performs some element of character development, as opposed to, oh, we just accidentally happened to bump into these guys and now we had to fight them on the way home, right? Like,
yep.
That where the action scene actually means something to the characters. Like, do you share that philosophy? Or
yeah.
I sense that you did from watching the film, so I'm curious if you had any thoughts on it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost like I've kind of going down that tip of, you can't have good action without good story. It's like, almost, I can't really do anything without a story or a motive. Like, you know, that cliche, what's my motivation? It's like, yeah, it is kind of similar to that. It's like, I can, me and my action team, we can come up with cool moves in a cool scene, but like, what does it all kind of build up to? You know, so the question that we're always kind of looking for is like, what's the payoff? What is this all? What are we all trying to aim for so that the audience can have something to enjoy or be thrilled or excited by? But, you know, if you can hook them, not just by their eyes, but by their heart, you know, that's the power of cinema. And even like on the Western side, you know, James Cameron, Spielberg and Brad Bird and Edgar Wright, you know, I think they're all masters at this.
So let's talk about the Paper Tigers, right?
Yeah.
At the time that you were gearing up to make this film, what was your life like at that point? Like, what were you doing full-time at the time? Like, how are you surviving at the time? Were you doing filmmaking full-time? What was going on?
Yeah, I was bouncing around. So I think I was, you know, in search of a feature, right? So I made a lot of shorts and they did well, but, you know, you're kind of ready. You don't want to be the shorts guy, right? So I think everybody has to kind of get ready and gear up for their first feature. So I was along that tip as well. I ended up doing going out to work out in Vietnam, because a lot of filmmakers my generation, or Vietnamese American filmmakers, or even Asian American filmmakers of my age and my generation, have actually gone back to Asia, to kind of their respective homelands, to make films. And Vietnam in particular is kind of a hotbed for that. I have a lot of peers and a lot of friends that have gone back to work in the industry in Vietnam, doing local language films for the local audience, right? So that was like popping off in a big way, and they needed basically an editor. So a lot of my friends who were already directing, but they needed an editor. And for me, I don't really fancy myself as an editor by trade, but, you know, because I learned to kind of do all the things well enough, you know, I went over there to work on some films out there. So I think it was somewhere about that time I was kind of toying with this idea. I didn't really have a full grasp of it yet. I was, I think I had pitched it at a lab, a film lab, down in LA Asian Pacific Film Festival. And then I, you know, absconded to Vietnam to work for a couple films. So that kind of like put it on pause. So I was going back and forth in terms of like writing it, but also editing for others. So that was the mind space that I was in for the first couple of years of doing it, which is basically, you know, 10 years now to where we are now.
Yeah. And how did the idea for the film come about? And we should say the film is about the film, The Paper Tigers, is about three middle-aged men who have to avenge their fallen master. When did you first start getting the idea for this?
Yeah, I think it was I was feeling some kind of way, like in the same sense that it was just so hard to get a first feature off the ground and all those things. And I thought it was hard back then. It was like, yeah, I should he should have talked to me now, see what that was like. But, you know, I was feeling a little burnt out about the industry, about the kind of the way things were kind of like set up, whether the cards were stacked against me or whatever, or anyone really trying to, you know, make their way into the so-called industry. So
yeah,
can we
pause there for a moment?
Yeah.
I'm curious, like what had you tried to accomplish that you hadn't accomplished that gave you that frustration?
Well, I'd shopped some scripts around before that. So I had some other ideas, and maybe it was just too expensive or just wasn't able to be made at that time. But just kind of seeing the way things were set up in a way where it was like very, it still is, you know, it was at that time vampires were really in, right? So at that time, like, that was a big trend. If you don't have a vampire script, you know, you can't really make it and blah, blah, blah. So a lot of those things were seem kind of goofy to me, and just the way that the city or the town, you know, kind of chases trends and kind of green light stuff that, you know, ultimately doesn't really, is not very memorable, to be honest. Like, I don't think many people can rattle off too many vampire movies from that time period that, you know, kind of stand the test of time.
So were you at the time trying to get financing for like a feature as a first time filmmaker? Is that what was happening?
Yeah. Same drill. I mean, like I said, after you do a short, you're pretty much kind of like, you know, what's the next thing on your track? It is a first feature. Either you get onto someone else's feature, or do you do it independently or whatnot.
Right.
But you know, I was doing all that, and even just general, like a lot of friends of mine were starting to fall away or falling out as well. So it's just in general,
like falling out of the industry, they're like giving
falling up. Out of the industry, but also falling out from each other. And these were friends that were close and that we had, you know, working relationships up to that. And so that was kind of like, you know, sad. It was because, you know, I was making movies, like I said, in the backyard with my best friends. And that was always the vibe that I always want, even to this day, about what it means to make movies together. You know, I think that's the best type of creativity. But, you know, I saw a lot of friends that worked together in previous films for whatever reason, ego, money, whatever, girls, you know, people have a falling out. And then the other one, like you said, it's like they burn out from the industry and they leave. And it's kind of a battle of attrition, right? So, I mean, I feel like I've seen, sorry to digress here, but I feel like I've seen a lot of people that are way more talented than me, way better at filmmaking, but they just couldn't hang on.
Right.
So for me, I'm just like, I just hold on by a finger and then just hope for the best. But you know, that's the kind of way it feels still to this day. Like, there's a lot of great filmmakers out there that have gone civilian and their potentials have been untapped. And I just think that's an interesting way to kind of see things, I guess.
Yeah.
But so anyways, you know, it's not what I signed up for. I think because maybe that's helps answer what you're asking about. It's like, it's not what I signed up for about making movies, and it wasn't what it was cracked up to be. So I was just feeling,
What do you mean? What do you mean it wasn't what you signed up for? Like what was the gulf between your vision for it and what it was?
Well, I think a couple of things. Like, yeah, like I said, I wanted to make movies because it was fun and I loved it. And it was passionate, you know, I was passionate about it. And I also tell stories to the audience. Like, I knew what the audience wants. Like, I could have a beat on that. And so it felt like there's a lot of middle people or people that like didn't really have anything to do or even cared about the audience.
Right.
They just wanted to pick their pockets. And so it just, everything felt like movie making was more exploitative versus like the actual grand storytelling, you know, vocation that we have.
It used to be about the stories,
man. It used to be, man.
Right? And And so you thought like the filmmaking industry would be mostly like, you know, telling stories. But in fact, we're telling stories to the audience. In fact, you're spending most of the time telling stories to people who will pay you to tell stories to the audience, basically.
Yeah. And that's and we can get back to that later. That's why it's so exciting to kind of like finally have our movie be out in the audience and let the audience and world judge, because that's all we all always wanted. But again, it's been to even get it made, you have to deal with a lot of middle people and a lot of gatekeepers and a lot of that stuff. So the same story back then. So at any rate, you know, I was just feeling it wasn't what I was signed up for, because that wasn't what the craft or the kind of the purpose of it. The whole play is the thing, right? So that's what we, you know, what I hone my craft for. That's what I kind of like dedicate my energy and my efforts toward, is to make the craft better so that the audience can enjoy it. But, you know, there's all so much noise and storm and drumming around that. It's about, you know, getting the trailers and getting the money and blah, blah, blah. So it's all those things like that has nothing to do with what I signed up for. So at any rate, I mean, but essentially this whole thing was just that feeling of discontent. And I think that's what it kind of led into this movie. Was I was also thinking about my other passion is martial arts when I was young. And I also saw kind of the same things there, like a lot of friends had falling out and people burning out from martial arts and as a profession versus as a art and a hobby. You know, it's a different thing when you actually have to start to monetize something, right? So it's very similar thing between movies and martial arts in terms of that path that I had. So then I kind of fed that into this idea for the story, is that you essentially do have these three guys who were once passionate about martial arts and for each had care and care for each other, and then suddenly poof, you know, all that's gone. And what does that mean now? Should they rediscover it, and does it have purpose for them? Is it still something that they want to pass on to the next generation? So that's kind of that seed overall, that emotion for the story.
What were some of your biggest film inspirations? Like you named, you know, Jackie Chan and so on, but like I'm curious, specific films that really guided you, inspired you when you were making The Paper Tigers?
For the Paper Tigers specifically, or just, yeah, is that what you're asking? Inspiration?
Both, you know, like The Paper Tigers specifically or in general, yeah.
Yeah. We'll speak for The Paper Tigers specifically. Like I love Shaun of the Dead, and that was like one of the, you know, big watershed kind of movies for me, because I wasn't really into zombie movies, but I really loved what the movie did. And, you know, and there had something, and also it seemed to have all the things that enough, you know, fan service, if you will, to people who do like zombie movies, did enjoy it as well. But for me, you know, I wasn't a zombie person. I actually wasn't really into the trailer when I saw it, but everyone was just telling me to see it. It was word of mouth. And so I gave it a shot, and it was really fantastic. Because not only was it, you know, this fun adventure movie, but it was also about this guy, like trying to grow a pair, you know, just trying to find some purpose and direction in his life. So it had a real character arc that I really appreciated. So that kind of gave it, you know, that through line that, you know, maybe I hadn't seen before in zombie movies. Right. So that was, to me, it's like, oh my gosh, it could be done. It could be done in a way that's loving to a genre, but also kind of like, kind of break the wall up a little bit and do something fresh with it. So we always thought like we wanted to make The Paper Tigers for Kung Fu movies, what Shaun of the Dead did for zombie movies. And I'm sure during the pitch, everyone's like, yeah, we've heard that before. Like, it's a very, it seems, you know, it's a comp, you know,
they've heard Shaun of the Dead everybody of said this Shaun. Genre. We want to make the Shaun of the Dead
exactly.
of romantic comedies.
It's almost to the point of cliche, but we really did mean it. Like Shaun of the Dead is a fantastic film. And there's nothing wrong with using that as a, you know, comp by any means. But I think maybe we're all looking at the different things, because I was looking at the heart and the spine of the movie in addition to kind of the fun and the comedy of it as well.
Any martial arts films that were an inspiration?
Yeah, martial arts films. Rocky. Definitely Rocky.
Not what I generally think of in terms of martial arts films, but okay,
yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah. I mean, that Rocky to me is definitely a combat martial arts film for sure.
Sure.
But it definitely kind of like the character grounded and stuff like this. I think in terms of the action stuff was a bit of a deconstruction. And to be honest, I don't think there was too much of an influence for us between me and my action director, Ken, because it felt like it was new territory to have like these sloppy guys fighting. Maybe they live as far as like that sloppy fighting, but I mean, that's kind of like kind of a different pitch and a tone. So, but in terms of just kind of like breaking it apart, you know, these guys who are, what does it look like to have these guys who are past their prime to try to fight each other, you know, and then really right. kind of like dig into that and double down and figure out what that looks like. I mean, it was a new design for all of us.
This is so interesting. I thought you were going to hit me with like a Drunken Master 2 or a Police Story or something like that. But
well, I mean, those are perennials for sure. Like, but I think that's why I was asking for filmmaking in general. Yeah, right. Those are definitely like reference encyclopedia stuff that we all look at, you know, for yeah. sure. But when you're asking about like this movie in particular, like I was thinking of The Big Chill, you know, thematically, it's very similar to The Big Chill.
Yeah.
But again,
I guess I just was very impressed by the rhythm of the martial arts scenes in this movie. Like it felt like heavily inspired by those, you know, movies that you mentioned earlier. Right.
It's in our DNA. It's for sure. In
you're
our DNA.
Just like, it's not even worth naming. It's just, it's already part of who you are. So
yeah, it's the repertoire. Yeah. I mean, those are all like, yeah, those are definitely in the firmament of great action cinema. So I'm not sure there's much more to say to that, but yeah, in terms of like just figuring out what it was, what we're not and deconstructing, you know, we just called it like Shaw Brothers in a street fight.
Yes.
You know,
excellent.
It's that type of sloppiness and tripping and falling and all that stuff
right.
that we wanted to do. And it was deprogramming for us because we wanted to, our eyes are built for creating like strong, powerful, like core, that's Corey's like training is like beautiful, strong and powerful. Like those are things we wanted, but we go for in general. But for this one, it's like, no, it's sloppy, weak and slow. Right. And we're trying to find what that looks like. And so it is kind of all of us. That's, I guess that was what was fun creatively.
So let's talk about financing the film real quick. Obviously financing any film, regardless of what it is very tricky these days. So what was your journey to get some money together for this movie and what you learned during that process?
Yeah, long and winding road. I mean, again, we were trying to do this maybe traditionally, you would call it, you know, going to LA, finding studio support, you know, at that time. I mean, at that time, Netflix was just like burning money left and right. We all know yeah. that period. Like they yeah. were just getting features.
There's
they just
writing
need to build
checks
their
left
slate.
And right. Yeah,
they it was definitely a, were. Yeah, they yeah. definitely were.
And you're like, yeah, you know,
what
about Bao Tran wants to wet his beak a little bit.
Yeah,
right?
We're over here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, at that time, you know, this is a whole landscape. So it thought like it was an easy enough to try to go out and pitch and get either a budding Netflix, at that time, budding Netflix deal or, you know, kind of an indie studio micro major type of deal and then just pitch around that. But they all have their business models and they were, you know, very, very strict about the stuff that they wanted to do. And like you said, it's about these three aging martial artists, but they're also three POC aging martial artists. That was very intentional that we wanted to, you know, set that world that was truthful to my martial arts experience, but also to Seattle as a martial arts region that had, you know, Bruce Lee teaching here and teaching multicultural classes and teaching non-Chinese and so on. So it just felt like it was the milieu was all we wanted to be part of that. So POC was like a non-negotiable, but when you go to these studios in their business models, they do want, you know, they need white stars because they're bankable and you can put them on a poster and blah, blah, blah. And so it's this vicious catch 22 where, you know, we don't have enough POC stars to be bankable or anchor a movie. So they want you to basically choose from this subset of white stars. And mind you, this was before Crazy Rich Asians and Black Panther, right? So
yeah.
All these conversations were, you know, people would say this quite freely and without shame, you know, and say this to us, you know. So we're very brazen, but that's the way the business is, kid. And so we did that for a while, and we had a lot of offers.
You did that meaning like pitching, basically.
We did the pitching for a lot of time. We just knocked on a lot of doors to try to keep going. And you know, it just didn't – we were just hitting a wall. And a wall because, you know, we never wanted to compromise. So any type of the offers that we had, you know, it was never a question that we were going to take them. So we were just trying to find the right partner, and we couldn't find it in L.A., let's put it that way. So we decided to kind of turn to Kickstarter.
And how long did that LA process last? Like it sounds like,
well,
it took a while.
I mean, everything runs in parallel, right? Because
yeah.
it's almost like you're talking to them and then you go off and do the thing, you do the Kickstarter, you come back and you follow up. So I mean, it's like it wasn't like, you know, everything was like clear cut because you're always
right.
like keeping it communications with people. And letting him know what you're up to, and you're like, yeah, are we now? You like us now? it's kind of
it
like
wasn't
that.
Linear, but would you say you spent like months, years? Like
it was a good 3 years. I think it was a good 3 years because we had you know, take time to kind of set up the meetings and pack it, and for us on our end to package things together and figure out the budget and the schedule and those things. So all those things are kind of like works in progress on its own. But like I said, we went to Kickstarter, but actually before that we had some money in place. We had some private money, friends and family money that was in place. So we ended up shooting like pages from the script. Cause what we thought was like, why not take this money and shoot a portion of the movie, which is where the heroes are younger, which is kind of that first 10 minutes of the movie, in the '80s and nineties, and shoot that out. Meaning just like, we know that cast, we don't need them, for the rest of the film. Let's shoot that out and have that in the can. And then we also have trailer footage that we could possibly leverage and use to kind of keep, you know, enticing financiers and investors. So that's what we ended up doing. And that's what we ended up using as footage for our Kickstarter. And we raised, you know, over $125,000 on our Kickstarter. And because of that, we found other private investors who came on board, who saw from the Kickstarter exposure. And got on board. So that period, that stage in itself was also maybe another two and a half years.
Yeah. Full disclosure, I'm one of those Kickstarter backers.
Yeah. Yeah. What up? But, thank you.
Yeah. So you ended up putting it together between Kickstarter and private backers, it sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, that was another year and a half. I mean, we had pitched to Frontiers, which is like kind of a genre film incubator. So we went to Cannes to pitch it, and we got our sales agent out of that. So I mean, like, nothing is linear, like you say. Like, everything's just a little scratching and clawing to get this piece of asset down or this piece of teammate, you know, in line. And so it was all like, you know, just pieces crumbling and falling together, and while waiting for the money to accrue. Because with a movie, it's like you can't really go until you have the money in place. So it's not like you can just, you know, a piece of software, you just kind of do pieces and pieces and iterate or whatever. It's like, it's, you have to have the whole nut to go.
It sounds like this was a extremely arduous and depressing period of your life. You know, at least the early parts when you weren't getting any traction with people in Hollywood. Did you ever doubt yourself, or did you ever feel like maybe I should just give up on this? And if so, like, what motivated you to continue?
Well, we have a team. So we have like four producers, you know, so when one is down, the other, we help each other up, and the other's down and vice versa. So it's like, this is kind of this nice little Voltron where we, you know, we're not all completely depressed, knock on wood, not yet. But you know, it is, but it's also all for one, because we just kind of, even of one mind, just when deals came across the way, I mean, there was no real like disagreement about what to pass on and what to take and whatnot. So there's that. I think there was kind of there wasn't a doubt, but I guess it was just like, we just didn't know how it was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And that is kind of like the question of the day, because it's like, honestly, like 10 years have come to Jesus moments. Cause if you build a budget and you're not raising the money that's needed for that budget, do you go, well, do we bump down the budget? What is it that's kind of keeping us here? Should we cut down on our shooting days, our schedule and our plan? And cut down on that, and then, you know, bring the barrier of entry down, and then we could get to green light faster, right? So it's constantly that type of question about like, is this the right shape and size that the movie needs to be? And then I would push back, because it's like, you can't cut days out of my schedule, because you have to, like, this becomes, we need time to shoot the action. You know, if the action needs to be good of a certain quality, we cut down on too many days, and it loses a thing. Because, you know, keep in mind, you know, there's a lot of indie and kind of like, I guess, how would you say this? A lot of indie film tutorials of saying, hey, set your movie in a room with two characters. And that's like, so, which is great, but it almost puts the cart before the horse in a lot of ways. Well, what's your story? Like, and for us, right, we knew our story had a certain scope. It had a certain canvas that we needed to work on. And if we cut our corners and tighten our belt too much, you know, it breaks. Like, something like that will break, and it can't be the thing anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously really enjoyed the film, but when I was watching it, I was thinking to myself, wow, Bao really didn't make it easy for himself. Like, there were some scenes that have like 50 background, you know, actors in it. I'm just like, wow, like, you know, you probably could have done it with like fewer background actors, but you know, you went all the way. And I mean, it looks great, right? But you went all the way.
Yeah.
And so it sounds like there's just like the scope of the film you just did not want to compromise on.
Yeah. And it's funny, ironically, when I wrote it, I was like, this is a cheap movie. Like, this is like not, this is not that expensive. But, you know, for the budget that we had, it's not a small amount of change. And for exactly the reason it took us that long to raise. But in this grand frame of a grand scale of movies, like we're way on the cheap end of, you know, movies and budgets for sure. Right. So it's like, you know, it is definitely a low budget movie, but we tried to make it look like it was 10x what we did.
Yeah. Are you willing to disclose what the final budget was? Or
yeah, we came out to about $1 million for the film, but you know, $1 million is a lot again for a lot of ducats, but compared to, you know, the grand scheme of things of all the other films out there, it's barely anything.
Yeah. And it looks, you know, many multiples of that. So I definitely think you like got your value out of that.
Thank you. Yeah. Sure. I mean, that was the goal, to just at least try to make it look like it was more and try to look, you know, give it as much bang for your buck as possible. So it also comes down to the team that we had too.
So it was obviously independently financed, and there are a lot of advantages and disadvantages to making a small indie film like this, right? One big advantage is you get to do whatever you want. Like, I mean, within the constraints of your resources, right? So yep. No one's telling you like, please cut this character or anything like that. Like it's your story to tell. Did you have any things that you were like, were there any times you were really grateful? Like, oh man, I'm glad I'm telling the story in this way. And then were there any times where you felt like, oh, I wish we had more resources or the backing of a major studio? And anything like that, just kind of asking you to reflect on the indie nature of the film production.
Yeah, I think all things told, like we ended up kind of going through making the film, and at the end of the day, like even when we kind of like press, you know, control S on the final print and started sending it out, there was a feeling it's like, holy cow, like at least we're in the driver's seat, you know. However the movie's going to be received, or whether it's good or bad or people like it or not, it's like we did this, and now our destiny is in our hands. Because if we took any deals earlier on, like they would have taken a pound of flesh.
Yeah.
And that's just the way, you know, the movie business is. So if we took any of these offers, any of these deals early on, even if they were favorable, but didn't necessarily mean that we had creative control, you know, this movie would not be the same thing. And we wouldn't have that decision making to be able to kind of like decide what's best for the movie versus decide, you know, under duress of like, oh, I gotta do this for, you know, the financiers or whatever.
Was there any specific things in the movie that you felt like really benefited from kind of being on your own?
Yeah, absolutely. I think just the fact that we were writing so many different moods and tones.
Yeah.
Like if we had other cooks in the kitchen, it would have like upset it, because it already is really difficult to find that balance between me and my editor creatively.
Yeah.
And then also, you know, our team also kind of like being on the same page creatively as well. But if we had other people who didn't like quite get what we're going for, like if you saw the work prints and you like kind of saw maybe just the assembly edits, like you wouldn't understand what we're trying to go for. But it takes time to whittle all that to get to that kind of balance, or hopefully that balance, right?
There's so few martial arts action comedies these days, right? So it's not like, oh, this is, there's a common template from which you can draw. I mean, there is a common template, but it's not a movie sort of genre that is extremely popular these days, right? The Rush Hour one is probably the Rush Hour franchise is probably the one that most people think about.
Rush Hour or like a Stephen Chow, like a
Kung Fu Hustle,
Shaolin Soccer, which are all great, but you know, they're kind of a different pitch, you know. We're kind of a little bit more low key type of martial arts comedy. So it's like, but if that's the only comparison that people have at that time, I mean, that's fair too. I mean, people now, they mentioned kind of Cobra Kai, but like, keep in mind, like we were doing this 10 years before Cobra Kai. Like I wrote this 7-8 years ago, before any of that. And the script didn't really change that much into production, except for some of the ad-libs and all that stuff. But, you know, we were already on the track of what we wanted to do. So there wasn't, like you were saying, there wasn't really that much to point to as far as like, well, what are we trying to go for? Like, you know, there wasn't a real comp.
Yeah. And so having that vision and being able to carry it out, obviously very important. Were there any times when you felt like, oh man, I really wish we had some more backing to you know, shoot a scene that you wouldn't have otherwise been able to shoot or anything like that?
I wish we had more time. It's always time. And I think that's always, you know, that's what every filmmaker and director is always going to beg for. But, you know, for us, it had that ironic thing where it was almost like Danny in the movie, of this perception of time, because, you know, you're sitting around in essentially development for 8 years, and it seems like a lot of time to yourself.
Yeah.
But then when you have the money in the bank and it's like green light, it's like go, go, go. And so our prep was actually super compressed. Our prep was maybe only about five weeks or so.
And how long to shoot the film?
6 weeks.
Yeah. So you're prepping for this 6 weeks for 8 years, basically.
Which is funny because you don't have any real logistics to consider until it's in front of you. Like, okay, we have this amount of money, and this, you can look at this room and that room. What do you want? Because right. Before it's all vaporware. It's like you just sit and like daydream what it would look like. But right. when you're confronted with brass tacks and confronted with the reality of, you know, what the budget can afford you and yada yada, you know, you make choices, and then you can actually make plans for camera, your floor plan and all that. It's just not real until you actually start doing that stuff. But what I wanted was time in that prep, because I was actually auditioning and I was rehearsing actors in LA while my AD and my production designer up here in Seattle were scouting locations, which is totally bass ackwards. You know, it shouldn't be that way. You know, I should be with the location scout, signing off, discussing what am I looking for. But they were literally like sending me pictures on my phone of what this three-dimensional space looked like. Like, it was just not a great way, not an ideal way to do it, but we made it work. But if we had a real timeline, a real time to kind of sit down with the AD and kind of like prepare the whole shoot, like that's the way it should be done. But the point is, when the clock starts, it's like you run.
Yeah. There's obviously many martial arts fight scenes in the movie, and they're very well done, very entertaining. Any tricks you learned or any recommendations you have for how to shoot a good martial arts fight scene? Like, what do you recommend when it comes to that?
Well, we would follow kind of the Hong Kong style, which is like you have an action unit, and basically there is an action director, even though the guild doesn't like me saying it. We have an action director. All right. So we have an action director who there is calling the shots, figuring out the shots, shot plan, figuring out the timing, and working with the actors to do that action. And, so that's a very kind of like counterintuitive way, the way kind of Hollywood does it, or kind of Americans do it, because it's still very top down. It's like the director, and then you maybe bring in a fight consultant or a fight choreographer or a stunt coordinator who has done previs or something like that. And then you take it under advisement. But ultimately, you know, it's up to the director to kind of like figure out what they want to do. The problem with that is that most directors don't really know how to do action. So if you kind of hand it over and give the final say to the director, it doesn't always come out very well, because the director might muck it up or change things and question why things were done the way they were by the action team. So for me, you know, I wanted to have an action team that I trust. I've worked with them for many short films previously, and I kind of give them free rein, and just kind of we talk about the process and the theme and all the things that I'm looking for, and then they're off to the races and they do it. So our style of filmmaking is very particular. So I don't know if there's a real advice to give, other than like try to learn and figure out how that's done, and find your tribe and find your squad that you can trust to do so. But also, when you're filming, is that you also kind of liaise between departments, because for Hong Kong filmmaking, it's like we shoot in segments, right? You shoot in little pieces of action that you end up cutting together and stringing out in your kind of a linear fashion of what the action is. Whereas traditional Hollywood filmmaking is, you know, shoot this big wide master shot, and then you shoot these inserts. You kind of go closer and closer and closer, and you kind of have like this kind of like pancake type of footage, and you kind of cut and weave in and out as needed. But it can end up being really unfocused and unclear, the type of action, because you're just jumping in and out between different shots, versus like actually pre-planning the sequencing of the shots for a particular angle, for a particular impact, and so on. So that's a very, very specific way of shooting, but also creates impacts, you know, technically, because your lighting has to change with each sequence that you shoot. So you don't shoot just one side of the wall and then the other side for time efficiency, you know. So it's a different process. It's a question of teamwork as well.
I want to talk briefly about the cast. You needed to find three guys that had good chemistry with each other, were capable of doing comedy, and also martial arts. And also, you had an indie film budget.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty tall order. How did you go about casting the main leads?
Yeah, so that's the biggest the thing that we had of going, you know, what exactly we were trying to do. Did we want, you know, a dramatic actor, or an actor could do like dramatic acting versus action acting, or can do action? Do you want a martial artist, a guy who's really good at action but is not the greatest actor? So for us, we kind of leaned towards someone who could act, with the hopes that, you know, they didn't have two left feet and they had some coordination that we could work with. Because at the end of the day, we wanted kind of the chemistry and the relationship of the brothers, the three tigers, to come across and to be believable. And then for the action, it was okay if they were a little off kilter or a little off step, because they are out of shape. So, you know, maybe I threw it to the action team, like, hey, you deal with it. But, you know, for us, we were like, let's just make sure they're good actors first. So that was a kind of like, you know, a creative decision for us to kind of make together. And we're all on board with that. And Ron Yuan, who plays Hing, was first. He was actually good friends with our producer, Yuji Okamoto, who's also an actor. So they all knew each other and had worked with each other on many projects years before. So Ron was kind of an easy get, if you will. Like he really fit the part, and he just felt like a great easy match. And also he was the most experienced in martial arts. So we knew he could kind of do all those things that was asked of him. For the role of Danny and for Jim, that went out to casting. You know, we went out to auditions with our casting director and basically searched high and low for anyone that was willing to submit a tape. And so that's how we found Elaine, who plays Danny. He has a taekwondo and breakdancing background. And then we found Mikkel Shannon Jenkins to play Jim, who has like a boxing background and has been in an action film before, Undisputed 3. But yeah, so I mean, it kind of worked out. But again, we were just looking for acting tapes first. And then we looked at their additional action demo reels and see if that was anything that could help us. So it seemed to work out for us.
Amazing. Amazing. I will tell you, when I watched this film with my little COVID bubble, me and my wife, and we live basically in a bubble with one other person. We all watched the movie together. We were, you know, it's just like screaming with excitement virtually every 10 minutes, because you'd show a very commonly known Seattle location.
Nice.
Throughout the movie. In some ways, the movie felt like a love letter to Seattle, because there's just very few movies that are filmed in Seattle, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Largely, I think, because of tax reasons. But I am curious what were some of the things you enjoyed and didn't enjoy about filming in Seattle?
Seattle's our home. Like, I think, yeah, like you said, it is a love letter, again, to the martial arts legacy that Bruce Lee left behind. But also us growing up, you know, the whole opening sequence, we have Kid Sensation, who was, you know, a well-known label mate of Sir Mix-a-Lot. And so that song is just that kind of puts you into that time and period. If you grew up here, you kind of know that song and how much his music was, you know, in the air at that time. So all the elements, you know, that we were putzing around Chinatown International District and shooting all these locations, and then just kind of all the kung fu elements of Chinatown and kung fu schools and the lore of, you know, these baymos and dojo busting, that's all kind of part of Seattle history for sure. So shooting in Chinatown International District was great, because the community was like super down with us. They came out and gave snacks to us. All the bakeries and restaurants, you know, would give the crew like little snacks and things to nosh on as we were filming there. So that was fantastic. There was nothing to complain around that. What was difficult? I gotta say it was pretty charming. Like I said, we had the community give us, you know, free locations to use to lay down for base camp and, you know, break for lunch. So we had all these places that we could count on and rely on, especially around the Chinatown area. Maybe I think if anything, maybe just we had a lot of plane noise.
because you're right near SeaTac Airport.
We're right in SeaTac, yeah. And even when we're up north, and just even we thought we were far away, but it's still under the flight path. So
yeah.
I guess I never really paid attention to how much air traffic there was until we were shooting, and there was a lot. And we had a hold for plane. I think even on our iTunes version, there's a BTS blooper reel, and then there's a whole reel of just us holding for planes. So you can feel a little bit of our pain, but I think I had PTSD from hearing planes and stopping for planes and so on. Planes, trains,
it must be really stressful because you're like, it's money, right? It's being burned up when you're waiting, basically. Yeah.
So. Yeah. And the margin for error on an indie film is just so low even as it is. So it's like now you're spending more time just waiting for, you know, these things that, you know, unfortunately you have to put up with.
All right, so the movie gets completed, and what was your kind of dream scenario for this film, right? I assume it gets released by like a nationwide, you know, distributor, and it's out in theaters and advertised to the gills and so on and so forth, right? Like I because that's what most people dream of when they make a film. But there are obviously many things that stood in the way of that, one of which was the pandemic. And so how did that old thing, how did the distribution unfold for this movie?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, traditionally you would make a movie and then submit to a film festival, hopefully a more prestigious film festival that where you could launch sales or kind of like make a big splash at. But the goal is to kind of get everybody in the room to see the movie together. And then you kind of build that little hype bubble and make sure, you know, the buyers are seeing the crowd reaction. They get excited by that and they kind of like buy it, you know, and you have this big bidding war. And, you know, we all kind of heard all those, you know, fairy tale stories of bidding wars. And so, I mean, these were all in the cards. We didn't really know exactly how we wanted things to turn out, but, you know, we always thought that was a possibility, especially with a movie like this, which is, we made this as a crowd pleaser. We want to entertain, and I think it's definitely best enjoyed on a big screen with big sound and strangers, you know, strangers in the dark. That's always the best way to see it. So like you say, unfortunately we went to pandemic, but world premiered at Fantasia Film Festival, which is out of Montreal, but they turned to a virtual edition for 2020. And so this was all online, and it was all kind of like through their streaming platform, which is, you know, hats off and kudos to all the film festivals that, you know, have pivoted and tried to make the best of it. Because at the end of the day, it was about the community and reaching out and engaging films with the community. So that's great. The sales stuff is, you know, all the glam on top of that. So obviously we understand the purpose of film festivals, just to celebrate, you know, cinema. But we did kind of lose that kind of experience where you had people in the room together. And so when we had actually launched sales, was actually we had the buyers get, you know, screening links. So, and, you know, so who knows how they saw the screening link at home with a screaming baby, with a laptop, speakers, or whatever. It's like, it's not ideal. Like,
I watched the movie on my iPhone 6 while I was on my Peloton, actually.
There you go. There you go. And I hope you got, you know, all your time in. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, exactly that. So, right. You know, buyers or so-called distributors and buyers are considering a film, you know, in that type of format and medium, like, you know, are they kind of getting the full flavor of what the movie could be?
Yeah.
And again, and even pandemic times, like are buyers even wanting to buy? Are they, you know, getting cold feet? You know, are their commitments as solid as they were before? So that's another question. But all things told, like, fortunately, we had Wellgo USA, which is, you know, specialty boutique distributor, you know, come in and want to acquire their film and make a statement. So we, all things told, like, it's been great so far working with Wellgo.
Yeah, I was so happy for you guys when I saw that news, because they are very well respected. I love the stuff they put out. They put out a lot of martial arts, a lot of action stuff, a lot of genre material, and they seem to treat their releases quite well. So. That was awesome.
When the genre releases is definitely on brand, if you will. You know, they've done Train to Busan and Yip Man, but, you know, peeling behind the curtain a bit is that it's a Taiwanese American mom and pop company out of Plano, Texas. You know, it's not in New York, you know, juggernaut. No. It's not in LA. They're in Plano, Texas, and they intentionally so, like, they started out, you know, selling karaoke laserdiscs as a company, And then they got into film distribution. And the CEO, Doris, is Asian American. And she really wants Asian American work. You know, she really wants that as a presence for Asian American films to kind of like flourish. So in a lot of ways, we were kind of that perfect hybrid for them. Like, it was genre so that they could still build, you know, off that strength. But also it was kind of opening doors in a way to have an Asian American, you know, work that's you know, plays at Asian American film festivals and is recognized as a piece of that. So I think it was a great kind of marriage to have us with Wogo.
Yeah. And it seems like you're happy with the results. I mean, the movie has ranked well in iTunes sales charts. It has a 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, right?
It's so incredible.
Wogo has done a good job of, obviously the film is great, but Wogo has done a good job of getting it out there as well. So that's awesome.
Yeah.
But last question, you know, and it kind of on that note around Asian American work. You know, obviously this past year has been a year where a lot more attention in America has been paid towards racial issues. And that applies to many different minority groups. But one of them is Asian Americans. And I am curious, you know, one of my favorite parts of this movie was when Carter, one of the white characters in the film, speaks in, I believe, fluent Cantonese to the Asian American characters, and they don't really understand what he's saying because he can speak it better than them. And they're very exasperated and frustrated, and also probably like mildly embarrassed. And it's definitely an emotion I felt, you know, meeting like a white person who can speak my language better than me. You know, it's like this weird, it's just weird. It's like, I don't know how to describe it, but this film like captured it. It was a very small moment in the film, but it did capture it. And I guess I'm curious, like, if you felt like the movie has something to say given the current environment that we live in, you know, and if so, like, what that is, like, what of your Asian American perspective do you want to come out in the movie?
Yeah, I mean, like, again, like I said, I wrote this, you know, many, many years ago, so I had no idea, you know, we'd have pandemic. I had no idea that we'd have these heightened kind of racial tensions. Obviously racial tensions have always been around, but not, you know, not to what we've been seeing. So I guess I'll sidestep kind of that question of where it is now. I think maybe we'll let some people commentate on what that means, you know, on the here and now. But for me, when I set out to write it, you know, I did want to kind of speak to our experience of, you know, kind of like exactly what you're saying, those kind of feelings of insecurity, insufficiencies, and not being able to speak the language. And what does that mean to be Asian American? Because you're kind of stuck between two worlds.
Yeah.
In a lot of way, you're not, you know, Asian enough for Asians, and you're not American enough for Americans, apparently. So you always have this kind of like in-between identity. And in a way, we've kind of formed our squad with each other. You know, I'm Vietnamese, but like my best friends growing up, and we're all not Vietnamese, but we were all immigrant children. You know, they were Korean and Chinese and Japanese and Filipino. So, but we all had this shared experience of being an outsider, of being in between. So on a lot of ways, we had our own core identity formed just by being that. And in a lot of ways, you know, some people are saying Asian Americans is almost its own cultural experience in and of itself. And I do see that more and more now. So it's the same way with this film. It's like these characters are kind of in between spaces. It's nothing needs to be said out loud. You know, it's not saying I'm Asian and I'm black, I'm here, I'm black. It's like, it's just like the experiences that they're best friends and they look out for each other. And when one is aggrieved, you know, all of them are grieved, kind of thing. So I think that's kind of the things that I was wanting to kind of put on screen.
Well, Bao Tran is the writer and director of The Paper Tigers, which is available for purchase right now on video on demand. The Blu-ray of The Paper Tigers will be available later in June. Bao Tran, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure, and it was a great chat. Thank you.
Welcome to Weekly Recommendations, the part of the show each week where I recommend something I've been reading, watching, listening to, drinking, etc. This week, I want to recommend an article by Molly Osberg over at Jezebel.com. She published it in April, but it's still good. It's called There Is No After. It's about how a lot of the media lifestyle industrial complex is trying to get us to move on from the collective trauma that we just experienced with COVID. But really, it's hard to do that. And we should understand and respect the fact that we've just been through something unprecedented and extraordinary. And if the signals you're getting from society are telling you got to move on and you're not ready to do so yet, psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, then you don't have to, because you shouldn't be expected to, because there's just still a lot to process and a lot going on right now. People are still dying every day from COVID, and humans need time to mourn and to grieve those things, and society doesn't really give us those things. So I hope you check out the article. It really felt like it spoke to me and what my mental state is right now. All right, on a much, much lighter note, Boutran actually was one of the first people on this podcast to recommend something to eat. Here's his weekly recommendation.
So I guess I just want to shout out places we've eaten.
Excellent.
And maybe some gear stuff. So out in New York, we have a great friend. She's got a restaurant called Saigon Social. It's in the Lower East Side. It's a Vietnamese joint. She was supposed to kind of do a grand opening in the March of last year, but because of the pandemic, it didn't come to be. But you know, she's essentially in perpetual soft open as of now, but hopefully, you know, things get better and there'll be an official opening. But they are open for business, and definitely amazing, kind of Vietnamese American kind of influenced food that you should definitely try out if you're ever in New York City.
All right, that's Saigon Social on the Lower East Side.
Yes, sir.
This is, you know, I've always said you can recommend something you've been eating or drinking. This is the first time someone's actually done that.
I went for it.
Including me. Like, I haven't done it yet either. So thank you. Saigon Social on Lower East Side. Thanks for sharing that, Boutran.
Yeah.
That's going to do it for us today here on Culturally Relevant. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you enjoyed this podcast, follow it on Twitter at CrevShow, that's CrevShow, or leave a podcast review at Apple Podcasts. This podcast was produced and edited by me, David Chen, and it was powered by Simplecast. Check out Simplecast.com for a great podcast management and analytics solution. They're awesome. You're awesome for listening. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.